Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing Death of Me, which Matt thought sounded like the premise of an old Twilight Zone episode, but I don't think it really panned out
that. The elevator pitch was... I forgot that that was even the movie that was. Okay. Remember us having that conversation. I don't remember. Yeah, right. So you pitched this movie to me as a couple seeing something prophetic on a television screen, and that there is an old Twilight Zone episode about that. A spooky TV repairman fixes up this feuding couple's boob tube, and then they see ominous visions of the future on it.
Visions.
Here, there's a scene very early on that sort of plays out that way, but it's that just them reviewing footage of a thing that has already happened. It's filling in blanks in their memory, but it's not oracular at all. It's just...
I never watched a trailer for this movie prior to us watching the movie and doing this episode, so I must have gotten that from a synopsis somewhere.
I'm sure.
That being the case, whoever wrote that synopsis is falling down on the job, because that is not really representative of what this movie is. Basic premise is that this couple, played by Maggie Q and the least handsome and famous of the Hemsworth brothers, Luke, are visiting this tiny island off the coast of Thailand. He's apparently a travel reporter of some kind, and so that's why they're there, trying to cover, I don't know, a festival or something.
But they seem surprised that the festival is taking place. But, I think they're mostly just documenting their own vacation.
Yeah. It's a good travel blog.
It's good work if you can get it. Jesus.
Right, exactly. So, yeah, and the film begins with them waking up in their Airbnb, smeared with a bunch of dirt, and trying to figure out what happened to them. And the movie just kind of goes from there. It was directed by Darren Lynn Bousman, who has directed a variety of schlocky horror films. Saw 2, Repo, The Genetic Opera.
Spiral from the Book of Saw.
Hey, for all we know, that could actually be decent. The movie's not out yet.
We'll see.
Well, I'm not holding out a ton of hope.
If Saw was a book, it would be written on napkins. Like, just calling it a book is way too highfalutin for my liking. From the Book of Saw. Good grief.
Saw Act 9.
Yes, like a classic Jacobean tragedy. It unfolds in 9 acts and counting.
Yeah. So, anyway, that's the basic premise of Death of Me. So, Matt, how about you kick us off with a synopsis?
We open with the aforementioned "What did I do last night?" scene. A couple waking up in a trashed Airbnb covered in dirt and soil and such, and their memories are hazy, and they realize that they're running late for the ferry to take them off this island. So they haul ass down to the dock, realize that they're both missing their passports. The wife is missing her cell phone, and they are not allowed on the boat because they're missing their identification.
So they head back to their Airbnb, having really no other options. They look around, they can't find the stuff that they were missing, and they're still trying to figure out what happened to them last night. They remember going to dinner, and that's basically it.
She is wearing a necklace that she does not remember purchasing that has ominous runes on it.
Yeah, he doesn't remember buying it for her, so they're just kind of confused by this. And so they elect to go through his photos from the night before, and they're not even cell phone photos. He's got a DSLR showing off his travel reporter bona fides. He's got a real standalone camera.
Yeah, so he pulls it up on a big screen, and they have themselves like a vacay slideshow, which culminates in them scrubbing through a 2.5 hour long video that they shot the night before during their blackout.
Yeah, it starts with them plastered, just completely drunk off their asses in this not-for-tourists dive bar.
Mm-hmm.
They get brought these drinks by this waitress that Luke Hemsworth is ogling. She, not even subtly, like right out in the open where they can see her, opens this vial and dumps this mysterious liquid into their cups.
A vial liquid, like, in every sense.
And, you know, what What is the, and before he can even get the question out, Maggie Q is draining her shot.
Yeah, party girl.
So he reluctantly goes along with that, and then everybody just starts acting real funny all of a sudden, just kind of like all standing up, and I don't know, it was just, it was odd in a way that was clearly meant to be ominous, but was just sort of peculiar.
The movie's full of shit like that, you know, sinister foreigners, wall to wall with that
in
stuff.
In fact, the subtitle of this whole movie could have been Sinister Foreigners. Yes. Death of Me, : Sinister Foreigners.
Wouldn't have been a worse title. I mean, Death of Me is just too generic to be remembered.
Right.
I keep wanting to call it Dead Like Me or Dead to Me or any of those other goddamn things that already exist.
Premium channel TV shows.
Right.
I guess Dead to Me, I think that's the Netflix one, but same difference.
I haven't seen any of them, which is lending to my confusion.
Sure.
I bet. But
sure.
So the video that they're watching, and this is the scene that somebody framed like it was a Twilight Zone homage when it's anything but them watching the footage from the night before. The video ends with them getting into an altercation on a lawn somewhere. They have sex of dubious consent, and then he strangles her to death. You hear her neck snap.
And, of course, she is alive, so that in and of itself is hard to square. Also, the fact that he, as far as we could tell, is not an abusive guy. They don't have an abusive relationship outside of this.
Yeah, I think you can fairly attribute it to the rattlesnake venom or whatever the fuck they drank. So we find out what it was later on.
Yeah, snaps her neck and then digs a hole in the ground right there and buries her.
Mm-hmm. She runs into the bathroom, has herself a freak out, and starts vomiting mulch into the sink. Basically, it's like half digested grass
and dirt, and yeah.
And as all this is going on, the new renters of the Airbnb show up.
I don't think they're the new renters. I think she's the proprietor.
Oh, is she? Okay, that's what would make
sense. Or the caretaker,
she,
or whatever.
She knows their name. Okay, I mistook them for other tourists. But yes, no, we do learn fairly quickly that they're locals or transplants, you know, that they're it's a white woman and her daughter, and they've been living on the island for some time. So you're right.
Yeah. And at this point, suddenly, I don't know if her neck was just obscured before, we never really got a good look at it, but now Maggie Q's neck just has choking marks.
Well, she's yanked off the tchotchke, I think, and we figure out pretty quickly that every time she takes off the necklace,
things get worse.
She gets deader looking.
Right.
In standard horror schlock fashion, we figure it out way before she does.
Right. They have a bit of an awkward interaction with the caretaker woman because Luke Hemsworth is trying to reassure her. Is like, you know, I want to hear it out of her mouth because it looks like an abuse situation.
Yeah, because he's like banging down the door when she shows up, bathroom door.
So they head out to the beach, and they're just trying to strategize about what it is exactly they're going to do. The rest of the movie, really, is just this never-ending sequence of dead ends and blind alleys trying to hunt for clues that lead to nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, they even name-drop Wicker Man at one point in an attempt to lampshade all the similarities. But it's a succession of sort of Wicker Man red flags, where, you know, the whole town's in on it, that kind of thing. He sees a parade float that is designed to look like his wife, which happens like right now, basically. It happens early on, and after that point, the jig is up, I would say.
Yeah, it's just Thai Wicker Man. It's Bamboo Man, or whatever. Luke Hemsworth at one point makes a joke about, well, in Wicker Man, he didn't have a cell phone. Who did he call?
They go to a doctor. Nothing much comes of that. There's a kind of funny moment, maybe on purpose, where they show him the footage to try to impress upon him, like, no, my wife died. You know, this is the malady that we want you to treat. Explain to me how she's not still 6 feet under. And he looks at the footage and then gives them a kind of weird, coy, raised eyebrow expression, like, you guys are into burial play, huh? That's some heavy shit.
It's fucking dark.
So, but no, he either doesn't believe that they're on the level or he feigns ignorance. Who can say? Then Hemsworth is like mingling with a crowd. She sees a bunch of kids with black electrical tape over their eyes and mouths, and he sees the parade float. She vomits up a snake. It is kind of just one damn thing after another.
It really is. It's just, it's hard to keep it all straight.
A cabbie who was a dick to them earlier bamboozles Hemsworth and like steals his camera, and then Hemsworth chases him down and clocks him, gets the camera back.
Does he steal his camera or his phone? I think it's his phone.
Oh, it is, because he's doing some like vlogger stuff talking about the, oh, what's this weird festival that's not marked on the calendar?
Right.
Weird. Well, you know, I've went in Rome.
I'll just, you know, follow along with these creepy mask kids.
Oh, it's a My Wife parade. It's the annual My Wife parade.
It's this year's Maggie Q festival.
What luck.
We got here just in time.
So they track down the waitress who spiked their drink. Again, not surreptitiously, right in front of them. We get more sinister foreigner stuff where, you know, they all turn their heads in unison to look at the at the whiteys and then smile in a would-be
dead-eyed kind of
fashion. Yeah. And nothing much comes of that. They try to lampshade some of the xenophobic culture clash stranger danger by making the waitress who got them into this mess kind of hip and colloquial. Like when they talk about, I broke her neck, she's like, oh, kinky. That kind of thing. She's right. More, I guess, westernized than a lot of the other islanders. So up till now, I mean, we make it sound like this is all completely incoherent. Up till now, there's been kind of a through line. But after that, there's a turning point where it truly does just become a melange of nonsense. And it's when the husband is standing on a dock watching a local gut a fish on a little stump, and he takes the guy's knife and disembowels himself. And this is mere moments after he drops the Wicker Man illusion. So he seemed fine mere seconds ago. And then
he did seem a little out of it.
Right.
But not, yeah, not on the verge of hypnotism suicide.
Well, he drops this pop culture reference and then takes off his glasses when his wife's back is turned, and his eyes have this kind of milky film over them, I thought, or maybe not. It's hard to say. And then, yeah, he goes into a trance and commits seppuku on a fish knife. And his wife sees all of this and is, you know, distraught and passes out, comes to. There's a lot of crosstalk with a cop who doesn't speak English and their Airbnb hostess who is trying to translate. The tide is out. There's just a rocky beach underneath the dock because she saw him collapse into the water.
Right.
They were trying to hire a boat to take them off the island.
And there was a boat there, too. And now the tide's out. There couldn't have been a boat.
Just, right. So everything that she saw is impossible. Or is it?
That's just the takeaway from at least the second half of this movie, if not more. Yes. Everything she saw is impossible.
Right, so she just spends the remainder of the movie tripping balls, and what makes it even murkier is that she's periodically... So this is some post-break business that I'm going to try to dispense with in an efficient manner. When this movie first started, I thought to myself, oh, this has achieved a higher degree of cinematographic competence than any of Darren Lynn Bousman's other films that I've seen. Repo and Saw 2 are ugly on purpose, you know, with like desaturated colors and frenetic editing, which is inherited from the first Saw movie. Mm-hmm. All that kind of zippy, like Looney Tunes sped up stuff that you and I both can't stand.
Right.
And there was none of that in this movie for a while. But then every time she goes into a rattlesnake venom fugue state, the colors get desaturated and the editing gets kind of fucky. And you get the sort of Marilyn Manson-y, like, I don't even know how to describe it. It's just kind of Repo, the genetic opera shit. And that that starts happening more and more. She just spends the remainder of the movie lapsing in and out, kind of Bousmaning her way through a series of odd encounters, odd and increasingly violent encounters.
Yeah, and one of the things she keeps seeing is these, I think they're supposed to be old women, but just some kind of figures with their eyes and mouth all sewn shut.
Uh-huh. So the electrical tape kids from before were a harbinger of that, I guess.
Right. And so these figures keep turning up again and again. Also, the Airbnb hostess doesn't just show up the once and then later with the cop. She keeps cropping up periodically, mm-hmm. more and more as the movie goes on, particularly once Hemsworth kind of phases out of the movie. Bousman and the screenwriters have decided, well, we need another English-speaking character to swap in. So here she is. And she's outwardly friendly, but they don't really try that hard to hide the fact that she's probably up to something in on it.
Her heel turn is very telegraphed.
Maggie Q is trying to get rid of the necklace. It's like, here, you know, you can have it. It's like, oh, no, that wasn't meant for me. Like, okay, that's not fucking ominous as hell.
Yeah.
And she's making these fucking juice drinks for both members of the couple. And in fact, that's the last thing that Luke Hemsworth had to drink. So it's probably what induced him to kill himself.
Who knows?
Right. It's another point where she tries to tell Maggie Q that, yeah, he left right after he broke down the bathroom door. He couldn't believe what he saw in the video, and he wanted to get as far away from you as possible so he didn't hurt you again. And all throughout this, like, we have our pet theory, but at the end of the day, there's nothing to ground yourself with or latch on to decide, okay, this is probably true. This is probably... you can barely make educated guesses mm-hmm. about what is happening or what is supposed to be happening.
And, you know, there's a lot of great cult movies that are ambiguous in that way. And even Midsommar, which I liked a lot, is a Wicker Man ripoff where the characters spend half of it tripping balls. And that even was more coherent than this. You know, it doesn't have to be such a fucking guessing game. It's not an edifying guessing game.
It doesn't have to be. I'm not saying it has to be fucking Usual Suspects where at the end of it you're like, well, this happened and this happened and this is exactly what this is, and Kevin Spacey is Kaiser Soze. Sorry. 25-year-old spoiler.
Uh-huh.
I don't need that from all of my movies. I know in this episode so far and in many other episodes in the past, I've complained about narrative incoherence, and it probably sounds like any time a movie is even vaguely ambiguous, I just throw up my hands in frustration. That's not...
And then throw up mulch and a snake.
That's not who I am. I just want to make that clear. This movie is gibberish.
Well, yeah, and it's kind of inept gibberish. I mean, I can make allowances for, you know, a movie can exist to do nothing but disorient and distress you, and I can have a good time with that or a bad time that I respect. This is not one of those. It's not like a fucking Inland Empire, you know?
Right. I like Inland Empire. Right. I like Lynch in general. There you go. There are my bona fides.
So during this stretch where Airbnb lady is the new sidekick, she accompanies Maggie Q to the doctor. Same doctor from before, I think.
Yeah, well, this is another red flag. Airbnb lady knows the doctor, and she's the one who sent them to him in the first place.
Right. So this time, the doctor and his, I guess, aide or wife or both unceremoniously announces, "You're pregnant." So as if all the concoctions that Airbnb lady was brewing and making her sip on didn't already give you kind of Mia Farrow vibes.
Mm-hmm.
There's some Tannis root witchcraft going on here.
Right. Well, and this is meant to be a big surprise. Maggie Q's like, that's impossible. There is no subplot in this movie where
her infertility was not established.
She's infertile. I was trying to figure out, is she supposed to be barren? Did he have a vasectomy? Is he just sterile? This was not prepared for.
Right.
So like, oh, she's pregnant. Well, okay, sure. Oh, that wasn't supposed to have happened. Well, how were we supposed to know?
Yeah. Q, probably the stupidest single shot in the whole movie. They're looking at the sonogram.
Oh, God.
And it turns into a screaming fossil. It looks like an extinct bird. That's like, well, it looks, it reminded me of when they're looking at the fucking raptor bones at the beginning of Jurassic Park.
Right.
And it looks up and goes,
I called it the gator baby.
Yeah. It's not human.
No. Also, why? And nothing comes of that, but whatever.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, well, okay, we'll get there when we get there. So part of the tedium of this movie is that she visits everyone twice. I mean, this is the second doctor scene. And now she goes back to talk to the waitress who drugged them again for the second time in like 40 minutes, maybe. And she finally wrings the truth out of her. They were fed corpse oil. That was the shot that they imbibed. And waitress has a sick son, apparently, and she proposes this deal wherein, what does she want?
Wait a minute, you just spliced conflated two characters. So there's the waitress, and they do visit her twice, I'm pretty sure, but there's also this tattoo artist lady, which is who you're thinking of.
Oh, and she leads them to the waitress. She directs them to like the shanty out in the woods,
right, where... the first time. Luke Hemsworth and Maggie Q go.
I was trying to elide this character completely and then accidentally
brought her back.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, they go. I don't know how they end up visiting her in the first place, but they basically try to pump her for information and throw a bunch of money at her for it. And that's how they get the address for this bar that they've already been to. But yes, Maggie Q circles back around by herself to this tattoo artist lady and makes this deal whereby, okay, I can give you this talisman, which apparently keeps her on the right side of the wobbling scales of life and death.
Mm-hmm.
If you get me off this island, help me find my husband and get us both off, I will give you this necklace that you can put around your son's neck so he doesn't die from whatever mysterious ailment he has. And it's like, okay. And then the doctor shows up and acts kind of ominous. And next thing we know, the tattoo artist is stabbing herself repeatedly with her ink needle.
Her ink harpoon.
Right.
Christ, it's like the length of my arm.
Right. So Maggie Q runs away and stuff happens. More stuff happens.
Yeah, she rendezvous with Airbnb lady again and she says, I'll drive you to the ferry. Never mind that I'm pretty sure she still does not have a passport. Maybe she's planning to be a stowaway
right.
at this point. Anything to get off the island. Fair enough.
Because the other thing that we haven't mentioned is, and it actually is kind of plot relevant.
This is established before either of them even wake up.
Right.
There's a news broadcast.
There is a typhoon coming.
Yeah, there's a weatherman on TV in their Airbnb the morning after who talks about how, yeah, there's a tropical storm bearing down on them.
But everybody on the island, Airbnb lady included, have been insisting, no storm has touched this island in over 200 years.
Yeah.
Then we soon find out why.
And yeah, the crops on Summer Isle never fail.
Exactly. So eventually we get this heel turn that, as Matt said 15 minutes ago, has been telegraphed the whole time, more or less.
And they still try to play coy about it in this scene. And I don't know why, because the little girl in the back seat, her daughter, who we come to find out is not actually her daughter. And this was a little bit clever, actually, because in the doctor's office, you Mystery Science Theatered a bit when they were looking at the satanic sonogram. And you were like, well, you have a daughter. You've seen one of these before. Because she was like, oh, wow, is that its heart? You know,
yeah. Like.
So we actually...
My mouth to God's ears.
Uh-huh.
Fucking Maggie Q says, I could tell you've never seen a sonogram before. That's
right.
Not your daughter. Sure enough.
Yeah. So the little girl in the back seat comes clean before Airbnb lady says, Mom, she's figured it out. Or, you know, woman.
Why are you still lying to her?
That's a little clever, too, because when they're first introduced, the little girl calls her Samantha or something.
Whatever her name is.
Yeah, and then Samantha or whoever, Airbnb lady says, oh, she's just showing off in front of strangers. You know,
right.
She always calls me Mom in private.
Right.
And that was not, like, a honking huge...
Yeah, there were no, like, sirens
yes.
like, setting off this
uncharacteristic this restraint on Mr. Bowsman's part there, so credit where it's due.
Yes.
Anyway, Airbnb lady starts monologuing. This is all leading up to some kind of sacrifice, obviously. Wicker Man bullshit. And Maggie Q buckles her seatbelt, pulls out a gun, and shoots her in the head.
Yep.
And the car crashes into a tree. Maggie Q extricates herself from the wreck, runs through the woods, and I think, is she waylaid by someone or does she just pass out? She might just, like, Bowsman into another fugue state.
Well, that's the thing. Like, she might have been... I think she sees figures, but who knows whether they're actually there.
At this point, she's having intrusive hallucinations about sitting on an idyllic white sand beach with her husband. They cut back to this multiple times. I know it was driving you up a fucking wall.
Just... it's awful.
Because she keeps asking him, what are we doing here? And then he smiles at her. And it cuts away.
I swear to God, the first three times we see this, it's exactly the... there, no progress is made.
The same clip, the exact same duration.
Right. And even if it's not exactly the same duration, like, nothing additional happens. It's just maybe he smiles at her for longer. Like, okay, thanks. Thanks for that.
Yeah.
But anyway, she gets picked up by these cultists from the woods. Whether or not they were there in the first place, they do eventually find her, at least. And take her off to be Wicker Man, essentially. The waitress, in conjunction with the doctor wearing some kind of big mask headdress thing, they're conducting the ritual, and the waitress gives her the rundown, says, people used to volunteer for this. This is an honor. Okay, so they used to volunteer. Why don't they anymore?
Well, then she tries to pull this letter of the law, spirit of the law bullshit. they get into this back and forth about free will that goes on for fucking ever, where the waitress is talking about how, oh, you could have left the island, but you elected to stay. And it's like, no, she never had a passport. I mean, she had the...
she was trying to find her husband who you fuckers murdered or induced to commit suicide or something.
Her hand was forced at every turn, and she was never operating with all of the relevant information.
Like, she had choices, I guess, but you made the choice you're suggesting she could have taken incredibly fucking unappealing.
Yes, and counterintuitive.
Yes.
Massively so. It's like you presented a rat with three pieces of electrified cheese. Oh, well, not eating was an option. Well, that's... it's not a fair experiment for anyone involved. And that's theoretically fine because Sergeant Howie in Wicker Man doesn't have all of the info and doesn't volunteer. And the fact that he's an unwilling sacrifice is part of the horror. Here, they drag free will into it, and it's just totally unwelcome.
Yeah, they keep making this point about how, oh, you know, it has to be a willing sacrifice. And you may just go straight Wicker Man. Yeah, just...
well, like, in Wicker Man,
we don't need a willing sacrifice. We just need a body.
Right. Well, in Wicker Man, they pay lip service to the idea that he played his role according to custom, that he dressed up like in the jester costume without meaning to. He's the right candidate for a few reasons, and he does hit his marks when he's meant to. But it is trickery, and they know that, and they don't make a big show out of how he wants to be there, because clearly he doesn't.
Right. Finally, it comes down to, well, you know, if I have free will, you know, let me go. And they don't.
No, instead they start sewing her eyelids shut.
She nevertheless manages to free herself and attack the people who are restraining her. And at this point, now that she has managed to free herself, the waitress is again like, no, no, nobody touch her. It had to be free will. She just asked to be released and you wouldn't cut her loose.
Right.
She had to prove how much she wanted to leave, how much she wanted to exercise her free will by breaking her bonds.
Yeah, if the knot had been a little tighter binding her hands to the post, then I guess her free will wasn't good enough.
Well, you know, they very carefully calibrated the tightness of the knot. They have procedures in place.
You know,
there
what
are rules.
This is residual saw cancer. This is metastasizing jigsaw disease, you know. Live or die, make your choice. That kind of garbage. God, he's so tedious. Well, if she really wanted to live, she would have. It's that kind of mentality.
If she really wanted to live, they never would have come to the island. Okay.
Fair enough. So, as she is fleeing and they're having this asinine argument among themselves, you know, no, she has to be a willing sacrifice, a torrential downpour has started. And that's the other wrinkle here. The little girl from before starts saying, you know, save us, Maggie Q. Character's name. If you leave, we'll all die.
Well, not my fucking problem.
Right.
She makes it out to the beach.
Y'all should have built some fucking storm shelters instead of sacrificing pregnant ladies at once a year for centuries.
Yeah. So she gets through the jungle and out to the beach, where there is very conveniently a dinghy waiting. It's not even, you know, a sampan. It is not a culturally appropriate boat. It's a fucking bright orange
emergency
rescue dinghy,
yeah, right,
like
exactly.
Inflatable thing. Big goddamn outboard motor. And so she's heads off, and like the first wave she hits, it just swallows her up.
Under the circumstances, I probably would have taken my chances with the typhoon also. But talk about a rock and a hard place. Again, she's only being presented with electrified cheese.
What? No, that she's being presented with electrified cheese and poisoned cheese.
Right.
The mouse, not knowing any better, eats the poison.
Mm-hmm. So, cut to the next morning. The island has been obliterated, just wiped off the map. We got rescue crews and emergency aid workers sifting through the rubble, bagging up corpses. And they find her corpse. I thought it was going to be the final shot of the movie. It's panning over all of these waterlogged bodies, and it comes to rest on her face.
Well, first,
with her fucked up eye.
Right. Well, first, they find, like, the Coast Guard finds the dinghy.
Right.
And, like, checks her and shakes the head, and then they tow it back in. And then, yeah, there's a row of corpses in body bags, and she has been placed with the bodies they found on the island. And they linger on her for so long, and we...
I think it fades to black, too. It's like, yeah. It's like fucking Return of the King. It fades to black and then fades in on something else.
But they even before the fade starts, they hang on her for so long, you expect, like, it's Darren Lynn Bousman. Of course the eyes are going to fly open, but not here.
No.
Instead, they cut to another shot where they're zipping the body bag closed or something, and then we see her face again, and then her eye flies open.
Because crucially, and this is more of a Gary Dauberman disease, they find the magic trinket and put it in the body bag.
And have dropped it, like, precisely so that it's sitting on her chest.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, so that brings her back to life. Because crucially, when they found it in the dinghy, the little leather strap has broken. It's not connected to her neck. So that's what killed her, not the typhoon, not the waves. The fact that
that the strap broke, right?
Her trinket was no longer on her neck. And
because you get the cursed object into the body bag, then she can reanimate. It's why I invoked Dauberman. It's hyper literal minded.
Yes.
There's not a whiff of actual magic about it. It's just fucking, I don't know, D&D at that point.
Well, we're going to go ahead and take our break, and then we'll be back with some more presumably negative thoughts about Death of Me.
Predominantly, yes.
I can't even remember how we got back to the room last night.
I must have taken some photos. There's a video 2.5 hours long. See if we can figure out what happened.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
I was dead. How am I standing here?
You hallucination.
You were never meant to see what happened.
Mommy, she knows.
And we're back. So, oh boy. Matt, what do you got?
I think they really fumbled the ball. So Okay, all right. I like, even when they're xenophobic, I'm a little bit of a sucker for this premise. I mean, I go in for, so one of my all-time favorite campfire stories, urban legends, scary story to tell in the dark kind of thing is, I think it's called The Vanishing Hotel Room. It's been giving me the willies since I was a little kid. It's about, I think, an American or an English woman and her elderly mother who are traveling in a non-Anglophone country, France maybe, and the mother takes ill. They're staying in this fancy hotel. The maitre d' dispatches her to this apothecary or something to go get medicine for her, and her carriage driver takes her on this really circuitous route through heavy traffic. They're gone for hours. She finally gets the medicine, comes back to the hotel, whereupon she's told, "What do you mean you checked in alone?" And she goes up to the room, and the wallpaper is different. Her mother's luggage is missing. And it just gives me the heebie-jeebies. It's just, basically, her mother had some kind of plague, and in order to not interfere with business, they just, like, did away with her and are just gaslighting the ever-loving fuck out of this poor woman. And that, like, just makes my hair stand on end. The idea that you could be stranded in a country where you don't speak the language, you don't know the customs, and you could be taken advantage of or done away with in some way. Call me an ignorant American if you want, but I think that's just a scary premise innately, right? You know, to be a fish out of water like that. And so I can even make allowances for a little bit of racism here and there in an otherwise good movie. I mean, I might dock points for it. I would acknowledge it if I reviewed it, but I can give you a little bit of wiggle room if you're tapping into that phobia and you're trying to evoke that specific fear, because there is fear of the other and kind of xenophobia baked into that feeling. And, you know, Wicker Man gets around that, I guess, moral pitfall because it's about scary white pagans.
Right.
You know, Don't Look Now, one of my favorite horror movies, taps into this feeling expertly, but it's set in Venice.
Right.
So you're not othering an oppressed minority group. So it can be done in ways that are more distasteful or less distasteful. But if it's done effectively, I can cut you a little bit of slack for doing a racism. This movie is not scary enough to warrant the parade of xenophobic imagery. There's just shots where, you know, Hemsworth, what, it's not Liam, Luke?
Luke.
Luke Hemsworth will be milling through a crowd and there's spooky music playing, but I'm not feeling the spook factor. All I'm seeing is a bunch of foreigners having a good time. You know, they're all smiling and capering and carrying on. And some of them are wearing creepy masks, but most of them aren't. You know, right. It's just like Mardi Gras. It's just like if you played scary music over Mardi Gras footage. I'm not feeling it.
And then showed it to a Thai person.
Yeah.
Fucking white people, am I right?
Yeah. So there's a weird moment. It's when the first time they pay a visit to the waitress, not to be confused with the tattoo artist, they're walking away from the shack where she lives with her extended family of unblinking creep relatives, casting meaningful glances at our protagonists. And they're walking past this table, and there might be one fly buzzing around this banquet that they've been eating. But what you hear is... and it's like Temple of Doom, you know, it's like it's monkey brains. It's like, oh my god, grow up.
Yeah, I've seen more xenophobic horror movies, but this one's probably up there. It's funny that you mention, what's the name of the story you said, the vanishing hotel room?
I think it's probably known by more than one name,
sure, presumably, because they do try to do a little bit of that with Luke Hemsworth instead of an elderly mother.
Right.
There is a point where, like, I think the cop that she's talking to says something like, no husband.
And yeah, right.
Maybe he's trying to say, like, no, don't wait for your husband. But the implication is clearly, like, oh, maybe Luke Hemsworth was never there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he's been dead the whole time and she took a vacation to, you know, get her mind off her dead husband. Like, the mind reels and it all turns out to be nonsense.
Yeah.
And again, okay, it's part of the, oh, they're trying to mislead her or, you know, unsettle her mind or whatever. But again, that just boils down to weakening the premise of free will again.
Mm-hmm.
If you just continue to lie to her and not give her all the information, how can you look at her with a straight face and say, hey, you chose to be here? It's like, well, if you had me convinced that the ocean around us was made exclusively of lava, and then I elected not to get in the wooden boat.
Right.
That is not an exercise of free will.
No, you're not making an educated decision about your circumstances, obviously. It's just, so you were just talking about how they kind of do the vanishing hotel room thing with the Hemsworth lad, Luke, when he vanishes. This movie opens with one mystery, which is then resolved almost immediately. And then nothing much happens for a while, and then it's supplanted by the what happened to my husband mystery. But the initial mystery, the what did we do last night mystery, I found more compelling.
Absolutely.
And then they see the footage and find out, oh, that's what we did last night. And then it's overtly paranormal from there on out.
Right. If they had had any sense, they would have spent the first half of the movie teasing out the mystery of what they did last night so that when Hemsworth disappears, there's not just this big chunk of dead time where there is no mystery.
Right. They should have done a horror hangover, basically, is what I'm trying to say. At least drag that suspense out to closer to the midway point.
More accurately, a horror hangover 2.
Yeah. Right.
That one is in Thailand, I believe. But yeah, I don't know, man. It's bad. It's not good.
Yeah, I mean, you were becoming visibly perturbed by it in a way that I was not. I think that your bile, your gorge was rising like higher than mine, if you want to measure it that way. But I didn't much care for it, and I was basically totally disenchanted with it by the end. I think I was prepared to extend it benefit of the doubt for longer than you were, but I was eventually disabused of that notion that it deserved benefit of the doubt. Especially by the very end. I mean, I thought that what I took to be the final shot was a good shot. I got the willies, the heebie-jeebies, from the camera panning over all these bodies and then coming to rest on her face. And it's just because she's got the one eye that's all jacked up. I thought, man, how spooky would it be to be going through the wreckage of a tsunami and find the waterlogged corpse of a woman who was obviously being tortured to death? You know, it's like, what did this hurricane interrupt? You know, right. it just gave me like any of those unsolved mysteries, like, you know, the Somerton Man or stuff like that. Like, how did this body wind up here in this condition?
Yeah, like, make that movie. Like, start a movie.
Yeah, there's your cold open.
Like, with finding this woman with a jacked up eye and be like, what? Hurricane shrapnel didn't do this. What fuck happened?
You know? But, what were these people up to?
That is absolutely not the movie we got.
Yeah, and even if that had only been the final shot, the movie would have ended on a high note, but then it has to go the more schlocky route and end with her, you know,
bring her back to life. Yeah.
Exactly. Speaking of random exhalations and inhalations, this movie is punctuated.
Oh my god.
Periodically. And the scare chord du jour is in this kind of would-be, I guess, tribal, like non-specific tribal noise. It's incessant, and it's just as cheesy and funny as if the soundtrack was periodically going, dun-dun-dun. I mean, that's how it registers. It's just a totally perfunctory.
I don't know if they were trying to go for a tribal tinge, but that's not what it is. Well, it is not Friday the 13th.
Well, it occasionally does sound very much like the Friday the 13th theme. It also reminded me of the cultists in Midsommar who do a lot of that, you know, but there it's like ritualized and contextualized in a way
and clearly diegetic.
Right.
Like we see them
that helps too.
Like doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that makes it weirder.
Just in general, Midsommar does this a lot better than Dead Like Me, Dead to Me, Death of Me. There we go. Got there. Midsommar does this better. Wicker Man probably does it better than any folk horror movie ever made. You have to impress upon the audience a sense of credibility that you're watching actual occult practice at work, that these people are actually invested in these rituals, that even if you don't know what you're looking at, you can tell that these people mean business.
Right.
And this movie just never achieves that. Towards the end, when all of the shamans are chasing her down the beach towards the dinghy, which just materializes out of thin air. The movie has reached the apex of its xenophobic slant, and they just look like the natives from King Kong. I mean, they're just gibbering, and like they don't actually, I mean, in King Kong, they actually say Ooga Booga. Because it was 1933. But this is basically Ooga Booga by that point. And then by that point, I didn't feel like I was watching. You know, Wicker Man, you know, and any good folk horror movie has to achieve a degree of documentary verisimilitude. Mm. There was none of that here. I mean, I thought of the claymation giant ape movie from the 30s, not the grungy, gritty folk horror movie from the 70s. That's the kind of caliber of the racism that we're dealing with.
That's the problem.
Yeah. And then she makes it off the island, and the tsunami wipes them all out, and that in tandem with the Ooga Booga just... I'm going to talk about Heart of Darkness when we get into our recommendation section, but I was reminded very much of the, like, exterminate all the brutes thing. Like, she basically nukes them from orbit.
Right.
I mean, she gets into the dinghy, pieces out, and then they're all obliterated, which gives the xenophobia kind of, like, genocidal underpinnings. And, like, yeah, if the whole town is in on it, they brought it on themselves, I guess, but I don't even feel comfortable saying that. And I had this movie pegged all wrong, because partway through, actually, like, 90% of the way through, I was still taking it as a foregone conclusion that she would be sacrificed. Definitely, for sure. And the reason I thought that is because I looked at this movie and I thought, they didn't budget for a tsunami. Obviously they have to forestall the tsunami, and I was a little bit wrong about that, because they do depict the rain and at least one big CGI wave,
but it's not even that big,
right?
It's, you know, when we say tsunami, it's not, we don't see a tsunami as such. We see like a kind of big wave that she gets swallowed up in, and then it just cuts to the aftermath where there was presumably actually a tsunami,
right?
And it's pretty clearly just archive footage of the wreckage after a real-life tsunami.
Yeah, which is, you're kind of distasteful.
Right.
But especially also, since you've just implied that these people got what was coming to them.
Right.
Yeah.
It's just divine retribution. Yeah.
Wicker Man also, crucially, is, I think, despite the fact that the main character is deeply religious, the film itself is deeply secular.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it's a secular movie about the power of belief.
Right.
And at the end of the day, he is put to death. As he's burning, he's like telling them, like, this won't bring back your harvest, all of that stuff. Nick Cage says, well, killing me won't bring back your fucking honey.
No, your goddamn honey.
Yeah, right. Thank you.
Very, very
important. Same idea, worse execution.
Killing me won't ward off your goddamn typhoon.
Yeah, except, go figure, the magic is real.
Right.
And that just, it just cheapens it, for me, at least, as a secular moviegoer. But even, I just think that these movies, the point is that they believe it.
Yes.
And you can't reason, it's like being strapped to the chair at the head of the table in the Leatherface house. It's like, these people just cannot be reasoned with. And that's a scary feeling.
If you want to wipe out the island, what you could have done to reinforce this point of, well,
right,
it matters what they believe, they could have sacrificed her and then gotten wiped out by the tsunami anyway.
Yeah, and that would have been arguably, I would have preferred that, although it still would have, all these silly superstitions.
Sure.
But that's, either way, it winds up leaving a bad taste in your mouth.
Sure. Not as much of a bad taste in your mouth, and this is sort of an anti-recommendation. So that's why.
Are you going to talk about fuck? Okay, carry on.
Yeah, I'm just going to throw this out here before we do recommendations and whatever else we might want to have in this segment. But there's an Eli Roth film.
Yes, indeed.
From 7 years ago called The Green Inferno. And it follows this group of college students basically on a spring break sort of white savior service trip.
Yeah, they're going to chain themselves to some trees in the rainforest to prevent a logging company from deforesting acres upon acres of rainforest.
Right. Their plane crashes, right? Their plane crashes.
I'm sure, yeah. It must.
Yeah, so their plane crashes and they get captured by the natives.
Yes, the very people they were trying to save. Checkmate, libtards.
Libcucks, beta simps. Yeah, it's just, thank God these terms weren't around in 2013. But yeah, so they get captured by the natives and imprisoned, gradually dismembered and sacrificed slash consumed.
Yeah,
cannibalized. And the Green Inferno is one of many reasons why I think Eli Roth is at best kind of a hack, and why it raises my hackles when people trot him out as one of the present day American horror masters.
Right. I mean, he's chummy with all of them. I mean, he moves in that circle, but he is a little bit of a weak link in my estimation. And I've only seen Green Inferno and Hostel, and I actually like the first Hostel quite a bit. So,
I hate Green Inferno enough.
I think I hate Green Inferno more than any movie I've seen in theaters, which we did see it in theaters.
Yes.
Back in the day.
Yes.
And I was mighty displeased. And it's not completely without merit. There is like one line of dialogue in it that I thought was pretty funny. And that's more than I can say about some movies. But yeah, it's Dreck. It's just an infernal experience. And it's like, you know, politically malicious, at least, you know, if you share my politics. If you're not just, I don't know, it's just a big troll of a movie. The punchline then is that the loggers save the day.
Mm-hmm.
The last girl, the final girl, is her goose is cooked, and then this big fucking fern gully machine starts mowing down trees, and the natives scatter, and it's capitalism to the rescue. It's just repugnant, and it's all a big homage to Cannibal Holocaust, a movie that I really like, unsimulated animal deaths notwithstanding. It's one of my favorite movies that I can't, in good conscience, recommend to anyone, just because the filmmaker's hands aren't clean in the humane society sense.
Right.
But in that movie, the Westerners who get gobbled up are pillaging, and they're bad faith documentarians who are staging scenes of native squalor and carnage in order to make this biased film that they're trying to make, and they're colonizers, you know, in no uncertain terms, and they end up getting their just desserts in the form of becoming someone else's dessert. But but here the white kids are well-meaning and left-leaning, and the feeling is still serves them right for being bleeding hearts. That's just, I don't know, call me triggered if you like. I just thought it fucking sucked.
Yeah, well, it's just, on top of how repugnant the film's message is, it's just not good.
Well, yeah, there's also just nothing to recommend.
It's just
it.
Like, there's no fun dialogue, except for apparently you think there was one line.
The first guy who gets cannibalized is a chunky kid, and he's got a crush on the main character, and one of the other characters infers this through his body language and quips, "There's nothing sadder than a fat guy in love." And I was like, that's... That line hits too close to home. But that was the one time in the movie that I thought, like, okay, well played, Mr. Roth. You know, that was the one broadside that actually connected, and that I was like, ooh, that stings, but I respect it, you know?
Right.
And nothing else in the movie felt like anywhere near a bullseye. They were all completely off target.
Yeah. The gore isn't fun gore. Like, if you're a gore hound, there are certain types of gore I feel like have more merit, just because they're kind of like, oh, this is balls to the wall and this is chaos. But it's literally just like watching a slaughterhouse.
Well, and it's
like,
not...
What's fun about it?
I don't
that?
Remember it being fun, gushy, practical effects either. I remember a lot of kind of dodgy CGI, especially when the guy gets devoured by ants. I mean, that was like something out of a Brendan Fraser mummy movie.
Oh, yeah.
But with worse special effects.
Yeah. It's bad. It's
so even if you're like a Fulci guy or a Deodato guy, it's not
watch
gonna...
Fulci or Deodato. Yeah. Don't watch Green Inferno, whatever you do. But yeah, so just in keeping with xenophobic, the natives are out to get us movies, Green Inferno kept kicking around in my head. And...
Dead Like Two of Me is not the bottom of the barrel.
No, it's not as bad as that movie.
So, as to how you might claw your way up closer to the top of the barrel, what am I going to recommend? Wicker Man, obviously. Don't Look Now, I guess. Any of the movies that I've already invoked. The big one I haven't brought up would be Serpent and the Rainbow, I guess.
Sure.
Which is about Haitian voodoo and being buried alive and does successfully tap into that fear of being a fish out of water in a foreign country. It gets a little silly. No, it gets extremely silly towards the end. There's a yes. lot of sort of mumbo jumbo stuff that I'm not even going to recount that I didn't much care for. But the basic thrust of the movie is quite eerie. There's a British thriller from the early 50s that's based on The Vanishing Hotel Room called So Long at the Fair. That's pretty good. I would recommend that. It was directed by Terrence Fisher before he started doing The Hammer, Frankensteins, and Draculas, and so on. But my official recommendation is going to be a film, I think from 2008, called Vignan. It's about a French couple who lost a child in a tsunami. I think like the tsunami that in 2004.
Right.
The big one. They, the wife in particular, in standard grieving mother movie fashion, have become fixated on the idea that their son is still alive, and they're very well-to-do, and they've been searching for him ever since, and they're going on this Joseph Conrad Heart of Darkness River journey through scary parts, off-the-map regions of wherever, into the wildlands, into the wilderness, looking for their son because she thinks that she saw him in a clip that she watched at some UN fundraiser or something. You know, she thinks that he's at an encampment somewhere or a monastery somewhere. She thinks that she glimpsed him out of focus in the background, and she's totally deluded in all likelihood. But this is basically all they have left. This is what they live for, is to chase any leads that present themselves, no matter how slim the chances are. So it turns into an Apocalypse Now, Heart of Darkness, Lord of the Flies kind of thing, where the white people shed civilization and set off into the unknown and the bestial nature of man. And, you know, when you wade in amongst the savages, you become a savage yourself. It's racist, obviously, but it worked for me. I mean, I don't love it. It's not like a 10 out of 10. You know, it's not as good as fucking Apocalypse Now or whatever. But right. It's a movie where I made allowances for a degree of xenophobia because the filmmaking was strong enough. So those are my bona fides, I guess. I am capable of turning off my conscience. Not completely, but it's like on a dimmer. It's not a light switch, but I can dim my conscience if I'm in the presence of a movie that is mostly doing it for me. Although I will still have caveats. The same way I said that Cannibal Holocaust has to wear this badge of shame because they butcher a turtle in unsimulated fashion.
Right.
So, like I said, not a spotless movie. Not an unsullied recommendation. Not an unvarnished thing. But it's not bad, in my view, even when it goes full bore into the Heart of Darkness stuff. If you want to see just an out-and-out classic film and you've already seen Apocalypse Now that gets into all that Conradian stuff, then check out Aguirre, The Wrath of God, obviously.
Mm. Sure.
But Vignan is my formal recommendation for the day.
So this movie reminded me of several movies from the mid to late aughts, not all of which I actually saw. So I can't recommend or decline to recommend officially several of these. You know,
I saw Turistas.
I was going to say Turistas or A Perfect Getaway. Mm-hmm. There's a couple different movies like that.
A few episodes ago, I invoked this Lovecraftism, Polyglot Abyss. The name Turistas is like classic. Oh, it's scary because I don't know what it means. It just means tourists.
Yeah, right.
It's not a scary word.
It's a cognate. You know, you look at it and it like that probably means tourists.
Uh-huh.
It sounds like tourists.
But there is still some knee-jerk part of me that's like, oh, Turistas.
Right.
That just makes me feel like I'm out of place, like I'm not where I belong. So it does work for me, as much of a cheap trick as it is. I don't know if the movie's any good at all. I haven't seen it.
Right. In any case, so if I had seen one of those two movies, I probably could have told you whether or not, hey, you know, watch this or don't. But another movie, it came out around the same time, 2008, incidentally, just like your recommendation, is The Ruins, which is about, again, a group of American teenagers, teenagers or college students who are like backpacking through Peru or Colombia or
thereabouts,
somewhere in South America or Central America, and they reach these Mayan or Aztec or some sort of ancient civilization's ruins. and they're lost. They need some place to hole up for the night before they try and find their way back out of the jungle. And so they bed down inside like one of these spooky pyramids or whatever the structure is. And the reason that this is at least somewhat related to Death of Me beyond just, ooh, exotic tropical locale, is that there are locals. We don't see a ton of them, but I think there are some more quote-unquote westernized locals, and then there are the jungle-dwelling quote-unquote natives, but we see them, and basically they all know the deal with these ruins.
Right.
And they know what the ruins are up to, and they more or less tacitly approve of what's happening, or they want to let the ruins do their work because it helps keep the jungle strong or whatever. So in that sense, that's how Death of Me reminds me of that movie. But The upshot is that when they sleep in these ruins, they get infected with plant life.
Yeah.
Basically, it's like in, if you've seen Annihilation, When Tessa Thompson gets run through with those like vines, those flowering vines. And then obviously, once they become especially visible, it's not long before she's just toast. And it's kind of like that. It's almost exactly like that. It's these sort of like green, but also bloody kind of...
Yeah, not quite flora, not quite fauna, somewhere in between. Carnivorous plants wriggling around under their skin, quite skin crawling.
Yeah, and they it doesn't end well.
Well, and what makes the ruins effective for me is that it's less to do with fear of the natives who are preventing them from leaving at spear point, which is a little bit King Kong.
Right.
But the main fear is picking up some tropical disease. Like you're traveling and you get like a bot fly infection or something like that.
Right.
It's to do with that tourist fear, that phobia, and it evokes that quite strongly, I think. And you've also got the creature feature aspect of the carnivorous plants, which probably sounds like Little Shop of Horrors, but it is actually quite scary. I like that movie rather a lot.
Yeah, the plants don't talk, you know, whatever. So it's not silly. But yeah, like Matt's recommendation, The Ruins is not a 10 out of 10 for me. I don't think it's a great movie. I think it's a fun movie. I think it is periodically frightening. But in general, it's a pretty good time. And so you'd be much better served spending your time watching The Ruins than you would by watching Death of Me. And I think The Ruins might even be like a few minutes shorter. So yeah, it's even more efficient use of your time. Well, with that, I think we're more or less done with Death of Me, which I think is for the best.
Yes.
So without further ado, I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. We will see you next time. As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Death of Me Trailer 2020, Maggie Q, Luke Hemsworth Horror Movie HD, uploaded by Joe Blow Movie Trailers. All rights reserved. Apologies to those who were expecting this episode to be about Brian Bertino's new film, The Dark and the Wicked, but that will be the subject of our next episode on Sunday, December 20th. See you then.